I would normally announce who has the first selection, but we have three trades to announce before we get started. The picks in this draft, 1 through 4, will be made as follows. 1, Atlanta Thrashers. 2, Vancouver Canucks. 3, Vancouver Canucks. 4, Tampa Bay Lightning.
The Vancouver Canucks are very proud to select for Marshall Schvink, Team Modo of the Swedish Elite League, Daniel and Henrik Sedin.
Oh, breaking news. The Sedins are retiring. This is breaking news coming out of Vancouver. The Sedins will no longer play in the National Hockey League after this season.
I mean, we knew this was the last year of the deal, and there came a time when we had to make a decision if we wanted to stay or if the Canuck wanted us back, and there's been a lot of talk throughout the year, and it started early, and we felt the longer the season went that it became clear to us that this was going to be our last year.
Like Henrik said, it's been getting clearer as the season's gone along. I think it's a happy day for all of us. I think we're very happy with our decision.
In the morning.
Sportsnet 650.
It is a big day in Canucks history. Today will always be known as a day the Sedins announced their retirement. I want you to call in and let us know, what has Henrik and Daniel meant to you? What are your favorite memories? The Nielsen and Langley.
I know they're part of Canucks family, but you wish they're a part of yours. That's how good these guys were. And I'm going to try my best to get some tickets to these games just to see the last two in Canucks uniforms.
Stanley, what's on your mind when it comes to Henrik and Daniel Sedin calling it a career?
I feel like I got a gut shot.
You know? Right.
I really think it's really rare, considering how they even came into the league, even that dynamic synergy that they had on the ice with twins. Now that they're calling it quits, I just hope that more people will start to appreciate the Art Ross trophies, the point races that they've had, you know, the 1-2 touch passes there that I don't think we'll see for a very long time.
It is the big story of the week. It's been the big story since they announced it on Monday, and that is the Sedins calling it a career. Two of the most wildly creative players we've seen in the game in the past 18 seasons. In a world where everything is north-south, they went against the grain and went east-west.
I really do believe, too, Jeff, that you had to see them in person to appreciate their play. TV did not do justice to the subtleties of their game. And I remember the first time I did a Canucks game at Hockey Night in Canada, and I saw them in their prime, like after the Morrison, Naslin, Bertuzzi line was gone and they'd kind of taken over. I remember watching it and going, wow, like, you have to be here to appreciate their greatness.
It's funny, if we can pause on that, because the one thing that I felt the same way, mainly because what they do isn't spectacular enough for television. They're not the fastest skaters.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the big booming shots.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do a TV performance
mm-hmm.
as well as some other players do. But the subtleties of their game, their body positioning, the way they find – Alex Burrows talks about them communicating like dolphins, right? Like
yes.
They just like grunts and sounds and no one else can understand it. But the brains are symbiote somehow. Like, I'm with you. Like, you have to go see them live to appreciate what they do. I remember once someone told me, a scout said this about Mitch Marner, and I've always felt this way about the Sedins, and this was the line, he doesn't make the right play, he makes the better play.
Yeah.
And I felt that about the Sedins. Just when you start to see a play develop and you think to yourself, oh no, don't do that, and then halfway through the sentence you say, oh right, that's why, like stuff that isn't obvious right away, where you think, okay, this is the right plan, this is what they need to do to be successful in this sequence, they wouldn't do, and it was the better thing to do. It wasn't the right thing, it was the better thing. Thinking one step in advance of everybody else.
People in the 80s, people would say that about Larry Bird, that as good as he was on television, you had to see him in person to see how he moved without the ball and the head fakes he used to create space. Isaiah Thomas once showed me on a court about how under the NBA's old illegal defense rules, if he took one little step somewhere, how the defense had to move or else it was a technical foul.
Hmm.
And, you know, that was the kind of thing you couldn't see on TV. I'm glad you remind me about the Dolphins bit with Burrows. I'm going to put that in. In Vancouver, where I would stand for games when I did games out there, was in the Zamboni. And the Zamboni area is where the Canucks defend for the first and third period. And in the second, when the Sedins would come down there and they would cycle, you could really see all that up close, like the noises they made, the subtle looks they would give each other. I remember the first time I did a game out there, one of the Canucks players, I said to, I think it was Burrows, I said, like, I'm going to watch them for the first time in person.
Yeah.
You know, what do I look for? And he said, that whole second period, just watch them when they're on the ice. Don't look at anything else. And you would see, like, did they even glance at each other, or did they just know where to go? Was there a nod? Was there a noise? One of those dolphin grunts that Burrows did. And that was when I really appreciated the magic of what those guys could do. And it is a shame, because I think that's why at times they didn't get the respect they earned. It's because it didn't translate as well on TV.
I was on Vancouver radio on Tuesday, and one of the questions was, were they outside of Vancouver as appreciated as they should have been?
And I think there were times in Vancouver they weren't as appreciated as they should have been.
You think so, hey?
At the beginning.
They struggled, though, at the beginning.
Yeah,
like,
they did.
It was a tough – that wasn't exactly like an Olympic diver into the water without a ripple. Like, that was awkward.
It was a challenge.
Specifically when you consider what was done to get them there.
Absolutely.
We played that off the top. The number of, you know, machinations that Brian Burke had to, you know, going to Chicago for the deal, going to Tampa, getting the first overall, flipping it to – like, to make that thing happen – I mean, Brian Burke, you know, really had to pretzel himself to make that come together. And so the expectation is going to be high.
Yes. And it shows you that, you know, we lose patience quickly. But I remember I went out and I did an interview with them once. I think it was 2011. And, you know, I said, like, about the criticism and asked them about the criticism in Vancouver. And did they ever take it to heart? And they were like, no criticism. You know, we don't really know about that. And I was told by someone who worked there who saw that and said, look, there's two things. Number one, you know, they wouldn't let it bother them. It's just not their way. But number two, they really don't care. They don't read a lot. They don't pay a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. They're perfect for our market because they're insulated. And when their contracts were up that year, when Brian Burke made the trip to Sweden as a member of the Maple Leafs to try to sign them, you know, everybody forgets that Montreal was lurking and Toronto was lurking.
Is Detroit lurking?
I don't know about Toronto. I'm sure they were. I mean, I'm sure there were a billion teams. I know. What they told me in Toronto and Montreal was one of the reasons they wanted them. Not only were they great players, but they'd proven they could handle Canada. Mm-hmm. They weren't bothered by it. And to play and be successful in Vancouver and Toronto, especially Montreal, it takes a special person. But, you know, I have this thing, Jeff. People equate toughness with, I'm going to growl at you and I'm going to punch you in the face.
That's changing.
Yeah, like Emil, I won't do this too often, but am I allowed to swear occasionally? Okay. I think that is bullshit. Like, I really do. I think that is such a BS definition of toughness. To me, and, you know, I think I've learned this like everybody else who goes through life, toughness is, do you grind every day? Do you show up for work every day? Like, maybe, you know, our wives are mad at us, or our kids had a bad day at school and they come home sad and you're worried about it the next day. In the case of a hockey player, your body aches because you're getting someone's putting their stick up your nose, or they're jabbing you or face washing you or whatever. Like, I remember Mike Babcock, when he had Zetterberg and Datsyuk in Detroit, he would say that those guys are tough because of what they push through. Like, to me, the Sedins were tough, a lot tougher than they got credit for, because they showed up to play every night at a high level despite all the attention they were getting on the ice and whatever they were dealing with off the ice, like all humans deal with. I think too many people have the wrong definition of toughness. To me, that's toughness.
Further to that thought, one of the things that's always struck me, and listen, every player deals with injuries, and, you know, you play that long in the NHL, you're going to get, you know, injured. And, you know, Henrik and Daniel have both seen their part of it. But considering how the game was, considering how they weren't exactly gorillas out there when they played, I was always surprised, and considering they held on to the puck so much,
yeah,
at how little they were hurt. I remember having a conversation once with Adam Oates, and we were talking about the Detroit Red Wings. It's a couple of seasons ago. It was just up in the makeup room here at Hockey Night.
Yeah.
We're talking about the Wings, and I was talking
about trying to decide who looks better in makeup, you or Adam Oates.
Oh, him all day of the week, every single day. Come on. I was bringing up the point about how injured a lot of these guys are. You know, with back and hips, and look what's happening to Holmstrom and Franzen and, you know, Datsyuk and Zetterberg, all the heavies, you know, so injured. And without missing a beat, he said, well, it's a puck possession game. He said, you get hit when you hold the puck. Mm-hmm. And here's a team that didn't like to surrender the puck. And the sidebar to that is you get hit a lot.
Yeah.
You're always getting, you know, physically punished. It made a lot of sense as it related to the Detroit Red Wings. And then I thought about the Sedins, and I thought to myself, well, how come they never got it as bad as everybody on Detroit? It wasn't as if, you know, they'd pull the pin out of the grenade and throw it away. Like, they held on to the puck, yet they never really got punished for it.
You know, the one time I know, because I remember Mike Gillis and Lawrence Gilman, I talked to them about it. There was one time that stood out for them, and they think it was something that really hurt the Canucks and in some ways began the decline of that great team that won two President's Trophies. And that was when Duncan Keith got Daniel Sedin. And Daniel suffered a concussion.
Yeah. That was right before the playoffs.
Yes,
too.
And they will say that it took a long time for Daniel to recover from that. He was hurt. And that was the one time he really got caught, and it had serious repercussions for their franchise.
Mm-hmm. Are you surprised, though, that it never happened more often?
Yeah. You know, another guy, like people always said to me to watch, the subtleties, was Scott Niedermayer. Like, there was a guy who carried the puck all the time, but he rarely got hit.
Yeah.
Like, who hit him? Ty Domi, an illegal elbow to the head? But how many times did Scott Niedermayer let you win the race and then take the puck from you so he didn't get hit? And first of all, now there's so much less hitting than there ever was, so the toll on bodies.
But now when the Sedins played, it was still cowboy time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It goes back, I think, Jeff, to what we talked about, that they were tough. Like, they were a lot tougher than they got credit for.
They're tough, and they made their own ice. Like, it was always fascinating to me, you know, you watch the two play and how, you know, with one turn, one shoulder fake, all of a sudden, I mean, that's one of the hardest things to do 5-on-5 in the offensive zone is buy yourself some ice, create some ice. Mm-hmm. And I was always impressed at how quickly they were able to get themselves in position to have a lot of ice around them.
Yeah.
Such a unique skill.
Very talented guys. And you know what? Like, if you watch that game on Tuesday and, you know, the big ones on Thursday, which were making a national game, I mean, yeah. Travis Green sang them out for the shootout. And I think
knowing that they're not good at it.
Well, Henrik especially, like, he, you know, Henrik was almost laughing as he was going down the ice. I don't keep a lot of souvenirs from. I mean, I keep my press passes just so I look at them. Oh, I covered this game. Oh, I remembered that.
Yeah.
But one of the things I kept was, you'll remember, Jeff, that a couple years ago when, you know, beginning of the year, some players would come through Sportsnet. We'd shoot, like, those commercials for them. Like, one I arm wrestled Tyler Seguin. Another I did one with the Twins.
Yeah, I did a beard one with Doughty.
Very few things in life say champion quite like a beard. Niedermayer, classic. Chara, outstanding. And while a lot of people think that I'm, let's just say, chin-challenged, I've got more game than people think.
Oh, hey, Drew, how's it going?
Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Are you sitting in on the panel with us tonight?
Yeah, I am. I'm a little nervous, though. Do you have any advice?
Drew Doughty, you're awesome. Guy, don't be nervous. Just be yourself.
Thanks, man.
Don't mention it. I can just think a beard.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah. And you remember they were wearing, like, these little windbreaker type things.
With just the numbers on it. Yeah, Seguin was here with 91. And then the
I Sedin's. Kept the Sedin ones. I kept 92 and 93. Yeah, I just packed them up because we're moving. But I kept Seguin's, too, because it was fun to do. It was different. It was the first time I'd ever been in a commercial. And, well, I really don't like those things or doing those things. I just liked having them. It was a good little keepsake. But I kept the Twins. And, you know, when they came to Toronto this year, it was 50-50. You know, obviously some people knew, but it was 50-50 as far as what I could tell. And I debated. Like, I never ask for autographs. I don't ever ask for anything from a player. I don't want players or executives or anyone I cover to think that I want something from them.
Right.
Aside from for the job I do. I debated it. I debated would I – because I've seen people do it before. Mm-hmm. Like, can I get an autograph from someone or this? And for the first time in my career, I debated doing it, taking it to Ben Brown, who works for the Canucks, and saying, Ben, could I give these to you subtly and you have them sign it? Because I just have that much respect for who they are. But at the end, I said,
it's
you know,
tough one.
I'm not doing it. I couldn't do it. At the end of the day, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do it. I don't want it to get out. That's not who I want to be. I want people only to see me as that guy only needs me for professional reasons, and he's never going to ask me for anything.
It's okay if you want to ask me for an autograph, Elliot.
You know
okay.
what I'm going to ask you? Why do you keep wearing these Guelph Griffins T-shirts? It's offensive.
It's where I went to university. I know you're a Western guy, yeah. So what? Deal with it, man.
That's all right. That's okay. You're going to work for us someday.
I know. That smug chant from Western. Get naked, get purple, go Stangs, go. Is that yours, Soggy Maitland, once upon a time?
Yeah, nobody wanted to see that from me.
Enough of that trip down memory lane. Let's start the podcast. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Terrain.
Okay, so Elliot Freeman and Jeff Merrick. I know Elliot a bit from just playing, and Jeff Merrick helped me along with my TV career so far. He's been excellent for me all along. And both of them actually came in very handy for me when I did my first podcast, which everybody enjoys, Everyone Thoughts. It's been great. I did a stick taping talk on the podcast, and now it's just blown up. I started a YouTube channel because of these guys. They've made me famous. So it's been a great run, and everything has worked out great for me with this YouTube. Like I said, Taping Twigs, check it out. It's just been a great run and a lot of fun. So hopefully it continues to go that way.
So what's our piece of his YouTube subscriptions then? It's Mark Savard.
When he becomes as big as that Logan Paul guy, I just want like 5%. You know, I'll tell you, funny story about Mark Savard. One of the times he came back from his injuries, Boston was playing Toronto, and he agreed to do a sit-down, but the Bruins didn't skate in the morning, and they'd played the night before. So the Bruins said, look, he's going to be at the rink at 5 o'clock. We're going to walk him right into the room. We're going to do the interview there, and we had to turn it around like an hour and a half later. So our producer, Shirelli Najak, was like, Elliot, you cannot screw up this interview. We're doing it live to tape, so yeah. If you don't like it, too bad. So Glenn Healy was still with the broadcast team, and he came in to watch it, and Savard was so good. He was fantastic. But in the interview, he thanked his ex-wife for helping him through it. And when the interview was over, Healy looks up and he goes, can I say something? And we go, yeah, whatever. And he goes, Mark, that is the first interview I've ever heard where a hockey player thanked their ex-wife. And we just all started laughing.
Good for him. My early memories of Mark Savard, I used to go watch those Oshawa Generals games when he played with that team on a squad with Jeff Ware would have been on that team, Nathan Peretz. And as highly skilled as Savard was, and he was, you know, arguably the best player in the OHL at that time, man, was he a prick.
Yes,
he was. With the knee pokes, like the pokes behind the knees, the little face washes, and then Nathan Parrott would have to come in
and solve all the problems.
But, you know, man, good, was he
good
skilled,
for, you know, good for Mark. Like, he told the story on our show about how he got drafted later and he stormed out and he missed
getting
drafted. And he made a hell of a career for himself. Good for him.
Maybe one of the nicest passers I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And as he points out, too, and he's always get ridiculed for it, every pass is a sauce pass.
Well, that's what Kelly Rudy said. He threw the best saucer pass in the league at the time.
Jason York brings up, I was talking to him, because Jason played with him in his final year with Boston. Mm-hmm. And he brings up the point that the one unique skill that Savard had that almost nobody else has, and watch for it in games now, like nobody really does it like this. He would take hard passes on rim arounds. He would take a hard pass on his backhand, spin around, and in that one fluid motion, pass right to the slot that no one else is able to do. Like, it's a unique skill set.
That's funny you mentioned that, because when Adam Oates was coaching Washington, he showed me that play that he was trying to teach it to Nicholas Backstrom.
Over the backhand on the board, spin and fire to the slot. And Mark Savard.
We did a game, Washington, Winnipeg, and he pulled me into the coach's office and he showed me a couple of examples of Backstrom doing it. Really, he said that is the play that separates the good from the great.
That is such a tough play. That is such a hard play. Thanks to Mark Savard. By the way, he's been doing a lot of Hockey Central at noon.
Yes, too, I've been hearing it. That's right.
He's been getting good. Some analysts.
Don't take my job, Mark.
Hearing footsteps. Want to point out as well, Judd Moldaver is going to be dropping by from CAA here in a couple of moments. We actually recorded this. You're probably listening to this podcast either on the Wednesday when it gets released, maybe listening to it on the Thursday. We talked to Judd on Monday shortly after the Sedin news just came out. So you hear some of his thoughts on the Sedins and also a conversation about Austin Matthews, which is fascinating. In the meantime, I want to pick up with the Sedins, but I want to talk about the Vancouver Canucks, because you write about the Vancouver Canucks. In 31 Thoughts this week, they just got a whole lot of cap space here.
Yeah.
$14 million to be specific, on top of whatever they're going to be left with, depending on what contracts they sign come July 1st. What happens with this squad in the offseason, and how much of it is contingent on whether they get first overall in the draft lottery? Anything contingent on if they end up with Rasmus Dahlin?
I think the Canucks are hoping they get some draft lottery luck for...
By the way, if they do, if it's the Vancouver gold card,
the
draft this year is in Dallas, please have Henrik and Daniel make the selection.
That would be awesome.
Rasmus Dahlin, get 22 and 33 to make the pick.
Although they might not want to give up this summer, like in June, they might be... I don't know, what do they do in the summer? Play at the beach? They may not want to give up their beach time with their kids.
Hey, let me ask you this then.
Too bad, next year it's in Vancouver.
I know, it would have been ideal, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's just, if they play their cards wrong, they might be able to select Jack Hughes first overall next year.
Right.
Quick thought. I'll get to Vancouver. Swedes are unique in some respect. There are some that stay, but by and large, the majority of them, when they go home after their NHL careers are done, generally they stay. Like there are a few Ulf Samuelsons here and Daniel Alfredson, but generally Forsberg and Matt Sundin and Nicholas Lidstrom and go right down the list. Generally, they stay.
Yeah.
Now, I know the Sedins have, you know, kids that are at school in Vancouver, very tied into the community. But do you see them staying?
I think they said they were going to. I think they said they were going to in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Working with the organization?
I don't think that's really been decided yet at this point in time. Like, they'll be able to do whatever they want to do.
Sure.
Like, I got to tell you, part of me hopes that at the end of the game on Thursday, they retire their jerseys right there.
Even before the Edmonton game, like after the Arizona yes. game, just guys, come out to center.
You got
ice
one
here.
More game.
Take
but
your jerseys
we're
off,
putting
boys.
Them up tonight.
That would be quite a send off, hey?
They should. Now, you probably want that night next year where you can do
bring
it,
them back and
but
promote.
How
it.
How awesome would that be if they went to center ice and said, "Yeah, take the jerseys off," and they put them on hooks and they took them up there?
Yeah. Oh, you know how I feel about retirements. You know, I still like taking your skates off at center ice and walking off. I still love that visual. Somewhere.
You can walk out like George Costanza. That's it.
I'm out.
No.
One day a hockey player is going to do that. I'm going to pop like the cork of a champagne bottle.
Like, I heard Vancouver had some interest in Michael Backlund before he resigned in Calgary. Now, you got to be careful how you do that now because you don't want to be caught for tampering. But, you know, I heard they were interested. He was a player they were looking at. Now, I think the smart path for them, because they're still building, is doing what Vegas did. They did Riley Smith and Jonathan Marchessault from Florida.
Look what they did to Columbus.
What they did to Columbus, Minnesota. Like, yeah. You can do all those things. Like, that's what I would do if I was them. I'd be creative. Like, we have cap space. How can we solve your problem and get help at the same time? But I do think that they are going to be in the free agent market, the big fish. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be surprised if what their argument is, like, we'd rather do short term and we'll give you maybe some big dollars. Like, I wonder if they're sitting there going, like, this is me guessing, but I wonder if they're looking at, like, some 3-year, $18 million deals or 3-21 or 4-24. Because I think they're hopeful that guys like Pettersson and Dahlin and Gaudet, who's there now, are eventually going to be their top six, are going to be their top six forwards. But they need guys from now to then. Mm-hmm. So that's what I could see.
But that was
doing.
The thinking last year too, right? That was part of the thinking of here's Sam Gagner because we need some players right now. Here's Michael Delzato with a little bit of term as well. Like, I understand
that. But I think
that.
There's some higher end offensive players available this year. Like, I'm sure they're going to say to John Tavares, can we be in this? I just don't see it right now. I don't see that being a place, although they could offer him as much money as almost anybody else can. If these guys want to win, Vancouver's just not at a place right now where they're going to be ready to win. But if you're looking for a short-term big hit, why not? And I think that's what they're going to try. I think they're going to try to plug some holes for a couple of years, and they'll sacrifice AAV to keep safe term. But if I was them, I'd be looking at the Vegas model. How can I solve your problem? And you can scratch my back too.
So essentially what you're doing is you're drawing up a list of the worst contracts in the NHL and a list of prospects slash picks and saying, how can I help you with this? I can take your, just so we're all clear, I will take your contract, but you need to attach this player or this pick to it.
Like Edmonton. You know,
Milan Lucic come home?
Well, I mean, Lucic.
That would be the obvious one.
But that's a big one because that's still got, I think, 5 more years. That's a tougher one, I think. Like, that's got longer term. I mean, you know what's going to be the interesting one? Eventually, not yet, you know, Winnipeg. The easiest one for me is, if I was them, I'd call Ottawa. You know, like, if you really want to trade Bobby Ryan, and Ryan has to agree to it, but if you want to trade Bobby Ryan and he's willing to do it, how are you going to make it worth their while?
Ottawa does have plenty of prospects.
Yes, they do.
Some high-end ones. It depends how much do you want to let go of that Bobby Ryan hit?
I mean, Dallas has got to sign Tyler Seguin, right? And he's having a massive year.
Yep.
Is there someone in Dallas that you can say, all right, how can we help your problem? That's what I'm doing if I'm the Canucks.
How does that marketplace react to it? They've gone through this 1 year where they're starting to see a little bit of hope, mm-hmm. right? Okay, there were enough moments in the season this year to act like the carrot in front of the mule to keep fans interested. Mm-hmm. You know, there was the winning streak to start the season, you know, flirting with the playoff spot. There's the Brock Besser story. There was the All-Star game. Like, there were enough things along the way. Everyone became a fan of Vekwa in the Swedish league, if you're a Vancouver fan, as you followed Pettersson this season. Like, there was enough along the way to keep you interested because you were buying hope.
What did they get mad at the deadline? They didn't get draft picks.
Yeah.
You can get draft picks this way. I think their fans will be happy with that.
Vancouver only has the one in the first round. There are some teams that have two. The Rangers have three.
Yep.
And Calgary, as you pointed out before, is trying to get into the first round.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that, I think, in Ask 31 a little bit later on.
Okay.
As the program continues. Dave Jackson.
Yes, I had a conversation with him going in the blog. He was really good. Like, he lives in Colorado, retired after 1,500 games in his final game. Came back from two pretty serious injuries to get that far. And, you know, he was kind of laughing. He feels like he's like in the middle of a road trip. Or waiting to go on his next road trip. It still hasn't sunk in yet. But a really good conversation about, you know, refereeing and what he wants to do and relationship with players. And
what did he say about that?
You know, he said that the biggest difference now is that, you know, they all charter. He said when he started, if you yapped with a guy on the ice or somebody was mad at you, you'd see them at the airport, you'd be having a beer. They'd come and they'd sit down and you'd kind of hammer it out, you know, like, I didn't like this. Well, I didn't like this. And he said that is the biggest change, is that you don't get that kind of time where you can take a player or a coach that maybe you don't get along with and hammer it out,
like, right,
have, make it better. He said the interesting thing is that the players who he probably gets along with the best are the ones whose fathers played in the NHL because they all know him. Like,
hey, so Matthew Tkachuk.
Yeah, hey Dave, my dad remembers you. Like that.
Hey Max, how you doing?
Yeah, like, you know. So he said, but he does say that it's harder to build relations, and plus, so many of the players are so young now. It's a younger league.
But good thing or a bad thing? I mean, on the one hand, I would imagine the league would be sensitive to officials having too cozy of a relationship with players or coaches, or having the beer with the players.
I told you the story about the one time I saw Michael Jordan partying in Toronto with one of the referees, and I was like, oh boy. You know, but you know what? I think, Jeff, there's a happy medium. Like, I do think one of the biggest...
Make no mistake about it. I liked the league when there was that kind of understanding.
And the NBA changed it first. Like, the NBA referees used to have a ton of personality. Like, there was a legendary referee, Earl Strom, and he wrote a book, and the NBA didn't want that anymore, and the NHL did the same thing eventually. Yep. I don't like that. I think it's a better game when the players and the referees have a relationship. He said the funny thing was, as it started to leak out that, you know, he was retiring, he said the players were great. He said it was, you know, the players and coaches saying goodbye and all that, and he said there was one player that came up to him. He just called a power play for his team against the other team, and the player skated up, and he goes, hey, I just wanted to say goodbye and shake your hand. He's like, I can't shake your hand now. Not after I'm just giving you a power play. But, you know, the other thing he said that was really interesting was he said he's worried about refereeing at the grassroots level. He thinks that a lot of these associations, they don't spend money on supervisors anymore.
Right.
And he says the problem with that is that, you know, if you're a kid now just starting out and you're refereeing 10 games a day or 5 games a day or wherever it is, you're being yelled at by coaches and parents and players for hours upon end. You go to your referee's room, and there's nobody coming in who said, I thought you did a great job today, or I really like you did this, or I saw this, and we can work on this, and this is how we're going to make it better. But, you know, I was really encouraged by what I saw today. He says, nobody does that anymore. They won't spend money for those people.
Yeah.
So you're sitting in the room, and you've been told how awful you are for 5 hours.
Yep.
And he says, kids are giving up. And he says, that is one of the things they really worries me.
Because I see all of those camps, and my brother-in-law is an official, and he's been to a bunch of them as well. I look at all those officials' camps, and they're packed. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if it's as much of a cash cow as, you know, camps for players.
He lives in Denver, so maybe it's different because he's in Denver. But where's your brother live?
Toronto now, but previously he was in Guelph. And Guelph is, you know, officials' hotbed.
Yeah.
And so there'd be plenty of camps that run in that area.
Well, that's good to hear. But he said that's one thing he's really worried about, is that he feels a lot of young officials give up because they don't get support along the way.
Do you know the Art Scope story?
Okay,
so he was an official in the 70s,
yep.
Okay? And there was always the belief, you know, when you tell me the story about, you know, Dave Jackson saying, oh, we used to be able to sit down with the players and sit down with the coaches and have more of a relationship with them and understand them a lot better. there was always the feeling that Art favored certain teams, specifically the Philadelphia Flyers, to the point where, and I think Art would have been the official during that Dave Schultz-Dale-Rolf fight because the linesmen were never told to get in, and Rolf took a horrible beating in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I remember someone from the – it was before a Rangers game. And I remember Rangers players saying it's the most embarrassing thing they'd ever seen and didn't want to be part of the game because of it. They announced the Flyers' record when Art was officiating before the game. And ladies and gentlemen, tonight's referee, blah, 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 Artscove. And here's the Flyers' record when he – and it was like 23-2 or something like that. It was it goes insane to the point where it's like, oh, man, is this guy like just in the bag for the Philadelphia Flyers? Because there was always that belief that that camaraderie had gone to the point where
that is so. Did he do the Bob Cole Russia game? I wonder.
That's a great. Well, they're going home.
Yeah,
oh, they're going.
They're
I don't
going
know.
Home. Bob, you know what? We got to get Bob Cole in here.
Oh, amen.
You know he's got such great. But I remember I once asked him about that game, and Bob was like, "Yeah, we put up with their garbage there. They should have to put up with our garbage here."
That's a great. That's a great line. We're going to step aside when we come back. We are going to talk to, from CAA, agent Judd Moldaver when 31 Thoughts continues. The all-new 2018 GMC Terrain is the compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. With features like the Traction Select system to revolutionize how you adapt to the road, a fold flat front passenger seat to give you up to 8 feet of cargo space, and an innovative electronic precision shift system to make shifting easier than ever, the 2018 GMC Terrain is truly mighty like a pro. GMC, we are professional grade. Judd Moldaver joins us from CAA. First of all, thanks so much for taking time out of your day to be with us here in person. Always appreciate that. Want to ask you what a regular day is for you, if indeed there is one. But first, we're recording this on Monday. The news has just broken. The Sedins will be packing it in at the end of the season. They're with CAA, certainly. Your thoughts on the Sedins calling it a career. Two of the most creative east-west players the game has ever seen. In a north-south world, they go east-west, and it's been a delight to watch them for so many years.
Well, yeah, thanks to you guys for having me. The news is just coming in for me as well, and I think speaking as a fan of the game, like we all are, I think they will both be missed. I think most importantly, the Vancouver fans and the organization there, coaching, management, teammates, and I think their fellow countrymen and what they've done for Swedish hockey over the last several years. Obviously, their story is, you know, completely compelling, and they're wonderful people, as I think it's widely recognized. And I have yet actually to have a chance to have an updated conversation with them. But J.P. Barry and Klaus Ellefalk did an amazing job with throughout their career. And, you know, we are all lucky to have been a part of it. And I think it's a happy day for them to look forward to the rest of their life. But I think a sad day for not just Vancouver Canucks fans, but the hockey community at large.
How early did you know? So this announcement comes out at noon Eastern, so not they time it for 9 a.m. in Pacific time, which you're normally on. How much sooner would all the people at CAA who work with JP and the Sedins know that this announcement is coming?
You know, these things sometimes, I mean, it really depends on the situation. In this case, you know, I'd want to chat with JP at that 11th hour where it was at. But from a group, you know, we usually know everything's case specific, usually within somewhat of a 24 to 48 hour period when something's happening. Like anything, the hockey landscape or otherwise, things are amorphous.
Yes.
Guys go to bed some nights thinking their favorite color is blue, and the next day they wake up, it's red. That's not hockey players. That's
life.
I think life, as you guys know. So, but I think that would be fair to say.
You know, okay. I remember talking to Trevor Linden a couple of months ago, and the question of the Sedins came up, and I asked Trevor, I said, when the Sedins play their final game, will we know? Will we know that it's their last game? He thought about it and he said, we probably won't, which is why, considering there's a couple of home games still and one road game in Edmonton that's still left, I'm a little bit surprised because I always thought they were going to be that pair that, you know, they didn't want the big hurrah, they didn't want the farewell tour, they didn't want that final dance around the NHL. Denny Potvin, everywhere he went, he got the awards, and the Sedins never struck me as players like that or that they wanted that, which is why, even though there's only three games left, I'm kind of surprised they announced it, to be honest with you.
I'm not.
You're not, eh?
No,
I thought they would just would have ended it, and then after the end of the season, they would have said, That's it. We're out. Last call.
I was doing some research on Saturday because we wanted to touch on it during headlines. And I think I kind of missed it a little bit, like what guys were trying to tell me because – Well, first of all,
have your decoder ring on.
No, first of all, or I wasn't paying close enough attention. First of all, JP like ran in here. He didn't answer his phone. So, and now I completely understand why he didn't do that now. But look, first of all, there were reports last week there was going to be a meeting, and I had guys telling me there was not going to be a meeting. So I was like, okay, what's really going on here? And then I had a couple guys tell me, look, I hope if they retire, they take their time. Like, they really think about it and don't do it too quickly. And I said that on Saturday, that guys were saying that they hope they really take their time. And I think now with 2020 hindsight, and I didn't realize it at the time, and they were kind of laughing about it when I spoke to them this morning, that they were trying to tell me without telling me, is that they knew what the choice was and they didn't want it to happen. So, like, I'm wondering, Judd, like, did anybody try to talk those guys out of it and say, guys, think about it?
I don't know, but I'm very confident saying that JP and Klaus, who oversees our Swedish operation, along with Peter Werner, had a lot of intimate discussions about it. And I'm sure went through the process like we would with any players and went through the pros and cons, how you're feeling and what makes sense. So I'm sure they had some pushback from various people because of, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I don't want to see them not play, but respect obviously their decision. And you know, they're great guys, and to your point, Jeff, you know, their humility, you think of the Twins, and so I think for them, I don't think they're big fans of the big, you know, hoopla and all that, but I think they have a lot of admiration and respect for the fans of Vancouver, and I'm sure that came into their headspace in allowing everyone to celebrate their career.
Okay, business question. Two hockey players like this retire, that opens up, you know, $14 million of cap space for the Vancouver Canucks. And, you know, every agent out there is like, oh, there's $14 million now that's up for grabs in Vancouver. On the one hand, the clients and, you know, respect the career and, you know, wonderful career, and you certainly celebrate that. At what point does CAA say, okay, now, how do we get that $14 million into our clients' jeans?
Well, it's the right question. I would say that, of course, we're always not looking for where holes are and where opportunities are for our players would be disingenuous. I think, like the entire landscape, it's early. For us, obviously, the mind's not quite there. Whether it's there or anyone else, I think looking where the holes are, looking where there's teams that have room, depending on what players we have that are in different states of their contractual rights, of course, we're open-minded to that. But for us right now, I think, and I can only speak for our group, there's a lot of data that has to be filled in over the course of the next couple weeks. There's playoffs, there's teams don't know quite yet maybe what they're going to or not going to do. So I think when we get closer to the spring, I think we'll have a, you know, better idea of how intent we're looking at that. Mm-hmm. But I still think Elliot should call Klaus and do this interview in Swedish. If you would be my recommendation, actually. But
I'll sound like the Swedish chef from the Muppets. And he'll sound like a normal human being. Okay, so let's talk, Judd. You go to your – how old are you, Judd?
37.
Yeah, okay. So 20 years ago, you're a student at Upper Canada College in Toronto, where David Amber's son goes now. And you decide you're going to play some NCAA hockey, and UCC has a connection to, I think, a Division III school, Colby College, and you play there. And now you're at CAA. And I meet a lot of young people who say, you know, they've seen Entourage or my generation, they watched Arliss, and they're like, I want to be an agent.
Dating yourself.
Well, I just say my or Entourage or whatever. They want to be an agent. What was your path from a typical Toronto teenager to what you do now?
Well, first off, I got to thank my parents, Goldie and Ron.
Who, by the way, you stiffed. You left their lunch to do this podcast.
I did. Jeff and Elliot are so important to me that I told them they can wait. My turkey sandwich will be there when I get back. So, but it starts, you know, like a lot of people, you have great support at home and great opportunities, so I appreciate them. And I have older siblings, Brett's my brother here in Toronto, and Kimberly in Boston. And so I had a great family core, and going to UCC was a great experience. I still look very fondly upon that. And I think, like all young kids in Toronto or Canadians at large, love hockey, want to be involved in hockey in one way or the other. You guys are involved in hockey. And so when I was in my teens, I was trying to figure out where's my avenue, right? Being a player at the highest level, probably not in the cards. Using hockey to try and play in school was an option. So I was doing a lot of digging and where I could fit. I landed on, even probably before the Jerry Maguire buzz, that, hey, this would be a good fit if I could figure out how player representation works and what do you need to do in order to be one, which I think is a question I get asked a lot by a lot of people. How do you become a sports agent? What do you do?
Yep.
So in my path, I'm empathetic to that because I went through it myself. And so I did a lot of research. I was calling, driving my parents crazy, probably a lot of other people, and discovered a company, IMG at the time, that Pat and JP were co-heading before Mike Barnett was there. And I knew of their names, and I was decided to play hockey in college. And through ending UCC and entering college, just trying to do research and trying to figure out how do I do this, I was fortunate to get an internship in the summer at IMG in New York in 2003. That went well, great group of people, nothing to do with hockey, which I also encourage people to do, like learn about the sports business in general. Did that internship and then called Pat's office in 2004, said, my name's Judd and I'll do anything pretty much to work with players. I love the game. I love players. I want to help them. You know, we're not always perfect as advisors or agents. I'm sure some of my clients sometimes will tell you that they're not always happy, but we do our best to make them happy and do the impossible. And really my path was that, just being a local guy that wouldn't take no for an answer, wanted to figure out who was the best in class. And I was fortunate to find Pat and JP, and they gave me this opportunity. 15 years later, here I am.
Give us an idea. Like, how crazy did you drive them? Like, how often did you send them a note? How often would you call? This is one of the biggest questions I get from young people is, like, for example, if I want to go in the media, how much should I tweet at you? How much should I, like, try to tell you? Like, so how aggressive were you?
However little aggressive I think I was, Pat and JP might differ with that. So my answer might be a little bit different. But, you know, I was on them. I was persistent. But I tried to be wise about it because, like you said, Elliot, I don't want to be annoying and have it backfire, right? And I'm fortunate, I say this with humility, to now be getting emails from young people asking questions. And I'd be lying if I said some people's approach is just better based on how they follow up, when, and the respect. But I was a nuisance. I was driving them crazy because I showed up in California. And when
they hired you to shut you up.
Yeah, pretty much. And that still hasn't worked. So we do a camp in the summer, and I met everyone there and a few players that are still clients like Sydney and Jonathan Taves, and we're at that camp, and I just tried to show them my work. You know, I knew they gave me a little opportunity to come out for a 7-day chance, and I knew that talking wasn't going to get me any further. It was, you put me in the, you know, in the rinks, on the rink, so to speak, and I have to play well. And so I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, talking is interesting. And I heard something, a story about you. This is a while ago. And maybe I'm biased asking this question because I did my degree at University of Guelph in English and philosophy. So I'm looking for an answer that I'm hoping I'm going to get here. But someone told me about one of your talks going back to UCC. And one thing you made specific note of to tell the kids is pay attention to English class. Mm-hmm. Pay attention with communication. Pay attention to how you speak. Pay attention to how you use language, because language will give you essentially enough rope to swing or to hang. The choice is yours, depending on how much you pay attention. Is that true?
It is true, and thanks for saying that. I maybe it's in large part because I wasn't that good at math, but I think communication is everything. I mean, I think within the hockey business, you guys see a lot. You guys are talking with different people all the time, and just in life, as you walk down the street, we all, including myself and my colleagues and my bosses, are on our phones all the time. And I was in that speech, I was trying to communicate, you have to lift your head up sometimes and look someone in the eye and show some personality. Doesn't mean that we're not communicating with our clients over text or email, because that is effective. It's all case specific. But I think the importance of getting your thoughts across clearly and also understanding what someone else is telling you. You know, oftentimes people are reacting to something based on a misunderstanding of what's communicated, and then there's a disagreement, and it could have been solved by just resetting. So I think how to express yourself, certainly as if you're representing people or talking on someone's behalf or in day-to-day, language is important and critical for, I think, young boys and girls to advance in their business career.
You also have a saying that clear thinking is clear sailing. What do you mean by that?
That's actually from my dad, and I pawned it off of him, and I used it.
All the best ideas are stolen.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Genius borrows, genius steals.
Yeah, there's a couple more we can list, I guess. But no, I think that the takeaway is exactly what my dad, I guess, was intending to say, which is that if your mind is not distracted, which I think comes with some confidence and belief in what you're doing, then the boat should move, you know? And I think a lot of people, and not to their fault, no one's perfect. I'm still trying to learn, get better at my job, be a better communicator. But I think I encourage people as well, connected to that, and the you know, clear thinking leads to clear sailing, is don't listen to the noise. There's a lot of noise around
yes.
you. Hockey players, non-hockey players, everyone has an opinion. You have to stay true to yourself and trust those around you that actually have your interest at heart. And it's a hard thing to figure out, but don't be distracted by things that are out of your control, and just be yourself and be authentically yourself. And that's part of what I try to do.
How often would you get then a call from a player, a text from a player complaining about something that someone said to them in the media, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on television, whether it's on radio? And how much would you work with that player to massage what they're, how they feel about it, and whether they should come back with anything, if at all?
Again, great question. The answer is hard to give in a blanket way. I mean, every guy.
Do players call you about that?
No, players never. No, players don't complain about the media at all. Players are. no, you
that
know,
never happens.
No, I don't know what you're talking about, Jeff. No, I honestly, I say this. The guys that we represent, and we're very lucky to represent all of them, they understand what they signed up for.
See, if I can interject. See, that's what I've always believed about hockey players. Like, by the time you get to the NHL, I believe this about every guy. By the time you get to the NHL, you've heard everything about your game. Like, it's impossible to get to the NHL and be surprised at what someone says about how you play.
So can I modify the question then? How many times do you get called by a player's family saying, I can't believe what this guy said about my kid? Or whether it's a wife or a friend or a parent or a brother or sister? Because my argument to the players a lot of times have been, that's where the problem really comes from.
Yeah, you know, and I look at it like this, and you're not going to talk to someone, and I speak on behalf of all my colleagues that are more biased for players. I mean, that's what we do, and that's what we live and breathe. I would say that players are human. Players have emotions. Players have wives or girlfriends or children, or they don't, and they have other personal responsibilities and such. So I would say, without trying to be, you know, tongue-in-cheek about it, that players are human. So, of course, there's emotions, and of course emotions are expressed. In terms of the families, families are the most important support system. So we are working with families all the time. It's important to do that. But I don't see it as our guys complaining. I'm really proud to say our players know what they signed up for. They have made the ultimate sacrifice. Their families have made the ultimate sacrifice. Their loved ones or their friends. And they have a great opportunity to play the game they love, and they're going to go through roller coasters, and we're there to manage that for them.
I wanted to follow up something you said earlier. You said you were given like a 7-day trial.
Yes.
So what happened during that week? I'm really curious. Like, what did they make you do, or what did they ask you to do during those 7 days where you knew this was your shot?
I was driving the vans, which was their first mistake because I'm a terrible driver. They gave me an opportunity to essentially be a camp counselor intern type and be around the guys. And like I said, I was fortunate. Many guys have played or still playing in the NHL were at that camp. Kyle Okposo, who is a client of ours, of course,
yep.
playing tonight here in Toronto. I've mentioned Jonathan, Jamie McBain. I mentioned Sidney, Jack Johnson. I mean, Carl Gunnarsson, former Toronto Maple Leaf.
Yep.
So it was, you know, I was 22, coming out of school, playing hockey, spoke the language, and I just knew – if the guys get along and I can build some trust with the guys, remember the trust I was building at that time was different than it is now because, you know, I was just a kid out of school wanting to be in the hockey business, but it was basically do anything and everything to make that week successful. And I said, well, I didn't tell them I was a bad driver until about the 7th day.
So. Well, they probably knew by then.
They knew, but they ran out of people to call. So
this is another one about a story I've told before that, actually, I told it last week about Dan Shulman, but when I was interning in the fan newsroom, I never said a word. Like, I did not say a thing until someone spoke to me. Were you worried about saying anything, or did you just never talk?
Unfortunately, I don't think I have that problem, Elliot. I think you guys know. No, that's a better question for Pat, JP, and Jim Nice, who had the fortune of sharing a space with me when I first moved out. I think I asked him at least 4 questions every minute. I'm not sure, though.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to Austin Matthews.
All right.
This is a biggie. First of all, here's the hardest hitting question you're going to get all interview long about Austin Matthews. Now, you went out to dinner last night with Austin, right?
We did.
Now, I can't remember if he told me this at his combine or it was at the draft. Does he still bring the bottle of hot sauce with him?
Not everywhere he goes. Well, he doesn't apply it. He might have it on him, but okay. Doesn't necessarily apply it. So it depends.
So describe for those that may not know, this is made by his mom. They generally takes everywhere to spice his food.
Unless Emma is going to correct this, I think there is a home recipe that her and Brian have. And I also think there's another brand they use, but it's a combination of those two. And for those, you know, that don't know, you know, Austin's mother is originally from Mexico. So there's a lot of Latin taste for him. And it's, I think, symbolic and both appetizing for him altogether.
Who picks up the check?
I do.
Good man. Good
man. I ask about hot sauce, you ask about money.
Yeah, that's right.
We arm wrestled for it, so now you know.
Yeah. That's awesome. Obviously, he let you win.
Yeah, correct. Correct.
You know, you played a big role in his recruitment. Jeff Jackson told the story about Sam Gagne, and Sam Gagne said, you've got to see this kid David O'Connor play, and you've got to see what he can do. How did Austin Matthews end up on the CAA radar?
We still have a good friend and a gentleman named Ron Filion, who spent time in the Quebec Major Junior League and did some coaching at the East Coast League level. He was out in California when we moved out there. I moved out there. And Ron had a history of friendship with Pat Brisson. He was doing wonders for Arizona Bobcat program at the time and getting into youth hockey and such. And like I think a lot of representatives, you know, you use your network of people you know and try and see what's out there. And we had a friendship with Ron. He had friendship with other advisors. And I'm sure he was telling different people, hey, this program's brewing. I have a couple kids here you should take a look at. And so a lot of credit to Ron to sort of tip us off. I think you should check it out.
I was playing a little bit when Elliot told me that you were going to come on. Looked into Ron Filion because I knew the Filion question would come up. And I'm trying to figure out how Filion gets to Brisson. And work with me on this one. So Filion played junior in Verdun with Troy Crosby.
That's right.
For I think 2 seasons. Is that how the Brisson Association works? Is that?
If I am accurate about this, that's true. But I think Ron knew Pat from being fellow French Canadians, had some other common
same
friends.
Ages.
Claude Lemieux, and I think is both good right. friends, has a long-standing friendship with Pat and with Ron. So a little bit of that local, just being guys in the queue, knowing mm-hmm. each other. They both ended up in California, kind of French-Canadian, small world hockey, some dot connection like that. And then actually, Jim Nice and I were playing men's league with Ron because we shared an office space with him when he was in L.A. And then he went to Arizona and we kept a relationship. And that's when he ended up calling and after he ran an East Coast League team and then said, hey, I'm doing youth hockey and there might be some interesting prospects coming out of Arizona. Fathers, no different than Los Angeles and these, you know, non-traditional places in the United States. You have a lot of passion for hockey and a lot of ex-NHLers or ex-pros residing, helping youth hockey.
Would Austin have played with both Claude Lemieux's kid and Louis DeBrusque's kid,
he
Jake?
Did. He
on
did.
The same team, wow. I think, one year?
They did. They either played on the same team, and when he played with those guys, it was before our time, but I know he's played with, in some iteration, he's played with all, I would say, one right. or all, if not all, of the Arizona prospects within, you know, a couple years. But I know he did play with those
Brendan
guys.
Lemieux, I think, for 1 year. I think Jake DeBrusque for 1 year.
Yeah.
I think.
They were definitely teammates at some point, for sure.
Okay, so now you played a major role in putting Austin in Switzerland before his draft year. Go into that story.
Well, yeah, it was. It took the work of a lot of people to make this happen, most notably Austin and his parents. I think as we've said before, both Pat and I, was really the core reason we did it was for development. And we knew that while that was the truth, because of the nature of precedent, that it was going to catch wind to be something funky and almost cowboy-like when, in fact, the crux of it was simply to put Austin in the best position to be ready to play in the National Hockey League. So as you guys know, late birthdays have, you can argue, a little bit of an advantage yep. in a sense for the obvious reasons, being getting that one extra year. And it was not an easy decision. We're fortunate to be very familiar with the European leagues, and the Swiss League was the one that seemingly made sense for where he was at. Mark Crawford was the coach. Zurich is a top-notch organization. So it just started to become and ideating with his father and internally. And as the season went along, you know, we went into that his last year saying, let's not make a decision about next year until time goes on and be patient. And credit to Austin, he did that, had an amazing year, his 18 year. And then as we got late in the spring and the summer, it started to become more real to say, wait, this is something we want to explore.
This was a real, I mean, you live this. It seems like it's a real unique situation. It's not as if this is a old floodgates and now this is an option for a lot of players. Austin, I believe, missed the cutoff for the 215 draft, I want to say by 2 days, maybe three. So he would have been 18 years old when that season in Switzerland started. So does that open certain doors that wouldn't be open to, a 17-year-old? Like, how crucial was it that he was 18 that allowed him to play there, where a 17-year-old wouldn't have that chance?
Really crucial, really crucial. And just before getting into the age, it was, you know, we all wanted to make sure that for him and his family, it made sense. So there was the vision of it. The U18s were in Zug, Switzerland that year. So it gave an opportunity for them to see what the environment looks like going over to Zurich and feeling that. A big holdup to your question, Jeff, was the age. You know, as you guys may recall, he didn't play the first couple games because in Swiss law, you have to be 18 to play professionally.
Oh, right, yes.
So it was a little bit, you know, he had to be a little bit patient until he did turn 18 and then was able to play. So that was pretty much the last sort of holdup once we went through the evaluation, you know, making sure Austin, his parents were comfortable. I think it's been well documented. His mother moved there with him. Yep. And, you know, it was the perfect storm, the right player, the right family, the right circumstance. And thankfully, it all worked out. And
on this podcast, Chad, Ellie and I have talked about the alternative universe of the NHL, you know, trades that never happened and how would it change, you know, the course of NHL history. I wonder if Switzerland, and I know he had options, I think as many as six schools to go to, BU, BC, Michigan, North Dakota, I think would have been one as well, Wisconsin.
And didn't Everett have his WHL rights?
Everett had his rights. Yep. And here's where I'm leading. And Seth Jones, the client. And Seth Jones, his rights once upon a time were held by Everett, but didn't go to the Western Hockey League until he was traded to Portland. Would Austin Matthews have gone to the Western League if Everett had traded his rights to Portland? Not unlike what happened to Seth Jones. Because there was that talk out there that, you know what, all Everett needs to do here to get this kid in the Western Hockey League is move him to Portland. And much like Seth Jones, he'll go.
You know, we collectively, when I say we, Team Matthews and Pat, myself and CA, our attorney Laura, we all, once the functional and technical pieces for the family were in place and Zurich seemed, it all seemed like it was the right thing to do, it was so just head down and let's make this happen that honestly it was almost pause because we just didn't want to accept, no slight on the NCAA or Everett or the WHL for that matter, both obviously amazing avenues producing a lot of top-notch talent, NHL and otherwise, but we really didn't even have a chance. In alternate universe land, it would have been tough. It's hard for me to even put my mind in alternate universe because we were just so this has to happen. It makes sense. We're excited about it. And of course, it was an arduous process due to some of the, you know, different challenges it presents itself in that process like that. But it's hard to say, you know, it's hard to say what would have happened. I don't know.
Toronto wins the lottery. Was there ever a question in your mind that Austin Matthews was going to be the number one pick and he was going to be a Maple Leaf?
Me personally, I was maybe blinded being, you know, while obviously fan of our players, you know, we work for individuals. But yeah, you know, being from Toronto, I'd be lying if I said that didn't have just a kind of cool element to me for it. And obviously there was a lot of great players in his draft year. I'm biased. I think we're biased for him. I would tell you honestly, I didn't think so, which is no slight on other players in that draft who didn't go first overall. There's obviously some pretty phenomenal players. Maybe it's because I wanted it to happen for him. So I just believe that it was going to happen. I think he had done enough. He had accomplished enough. And it seemed like it was going to make sense.
You know, I was wondering if like anyone ever called you and said, hey, I hear they might be taking Line A, or did you hear a rumor that Toronto was talking to this team about the pick? Did that intel ever come to you?
I mean, we talked to so many different people that you're going to get people that either generally believe X, Y, or Z, or maybe they want to make you believe X, Y, or Z. That happens in a lot of topics. So, yes, I'm sure in the plethora of conversations we had, no different than the Swiss thing, right? Kind of had people think, are you sure? Are you guys really sure about this? That makes sense. So similar to that, there'd be people like, you know, I'm hearing, and akin to what we said at the top of the remarks, we have enough experience, I say, fortuitously to envision what may or may not occur, but no one's a futurist. Things change from day to day and situations change so quickly that you never know. But we were all pretty confident. Again, not in a silly way, but we were confident it would happen.
You know, that was a fascinating lottery. And there was, you know, I want to ask you about preferred destinations. You know, there was that feeling that, oh, you know, Arizona, man, the kid goes back home.
Well, you want to know something? I got to tell you. So we did the draft lottery that year, obviously. Yeah. And Austin was in the middle of the night in Switzerland. And we had a camera on him just the whole time because he was going to do an interview after it was over. And I really like Matthews because I think he's got the temperament to handle Toronto. He's got that Sedin, whatever, you know, it doesn't bother me. I can handle this. He only had one noticeable facial reaction
Arizona
that whole time. And that was when Arizona didn't win. I think they picked seventh that year. Yeah. When Arizona came out with Bill Daly flipped the envelope, the seventh pick, Arizona, there was a slight grimace, like, ah, too bad. And that was the only expression he made the whole time. I was impressed.
It was fascinating because to that, there was Arizona, who, you know, local boy. Yeah. And what a wonderful story that would have been. There was the Winnipeg Jets angle. You take our franchise, we'll take your children, we'll take Austin Matthews, thank you in exchange for the, like, there was that kind of vibe about it. And going in, was there, I mean, emotionally, certainly, I would imagine Austin Matthews with his home state, but was there a preferred destination? I mean, with a lot of kids, Drew Doughty gets picked by LA. Oh, I've been a Los Angeles Kings fan my whole life. This is perfect. This is ideal. Did it work out in his mind perfectly for him?
I think it has. I think no doubt there's the probably more common, you grew up in a certain city, of course you're a fan of your local team, and so you aspire to play for that team, and or situations like, you know, a guy like Matt Duchene who grew up in Halliburton, he was always, you know, Avalanche, at that time, and obviously, you know, Matt's somewhere else now and having a great season now there. Well, hopefully things can course correct for their whole team next year and get back to where they want to be. But in any event, no, I think it happens in all ways. I think for Austin, no, I think he's, you know, he loves the city of Toronto. He loves the fans. He loves the fact that people care so much here and are so passionate about the game. And of course, you know, people can say, well, that comes with certain pressures, but I think he's embraced it all. I think he feels, yeah, going first overall is awesome, but I think he understands how much the Toronto Maple Leafs mean. He wants to play well for his organization, his teammates. And I think he's, couldn't be happier, to be honest with you, how it's worked out in all facets.
I'm curious about another part of your business, of course, securing sponsorships for your clients. Matthews is with Bauer. Is that the only sponsorship right now?
Just recently, Scotiabank.
Okay, because that was my question. At what point is it right to step outside of just hockey?
It's a great question and something we take a lot of pride in. Obviously, our role as advisors, representatives, is to guide guys through their hockey career and help them with all that stuff, so to speak, that gets them to be the best hockey player. When guys turn to professionally in the NHL, it's when there's a little more focus on how we can tap into these other opportunities. We've always been of the mind, and we've learned from other players we've been lucky to represent, we've always been of the mind, A, it's case specific, and balance out what he's most focused on, which is being the best hockey player he can possibly be. At the same time, you know, hockey players should, and athletes in general, take advantage, so to speak, of opportunities to present themselves. With Austin, you know, coming in, he wanted to focus on playing hockey, and we wanted to let him go slowly so as to perform on the ice. And so now he's, you know, he's got Upper Deck and Fanatics as a memorabilia partner, Bauer and Scotiabank, and, you know, we're getting phone calls, and we'll explore things again at the appropriate time.
He wants to do clothing, though, doesn't he? Like, he's talked about that before.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys spend, I mean, you guys spend more time with him than me, so you know. But he loves fashion. He loves clothing. He's obviously a stylish guy and has a great sense of what's new and what's cool and what's trendy. And I think it's awesome that he embraces that part of it. And so, yeah, I think somewhere down the road, whether that's in the short or long term, I think, you know, him doing something in fashion, something with clothing, might make sense.
You know, it was funny, years ago when my wife used to work at Cosmo TV, so one year I went to a couple of the fashion shows at Fashion Week, and Nicholas Hagman was sitting next to me when he played for the Leafs. Like, he was one of the guys, and I was like, there are a lot of guys. He says, you would not believe how many NHL guys would love to do this kind of stuff.
And you know what? There's a kid for the draft this year, Akil Thomas, plays with the Niagara Ice Dogs.
Yeah,
and he already has his own clothing line.
I think that's awesome. You know what, Judd? This is a good one for you. I believe that the day of no personnel in the NHL is coming to an end. The next generation will not tolerate this. Like, the NBA has got the reputation as being the fashion league. I really believe there is a whole group of NHL players just dying to do that, just dying to be in the clothing forefront.
I think you guys are right. I mean, our job as representatives is to adapt with the players as players adapt. And I think that whether it's our responsibility or just how a player feels, I think it always comes down to if you're performing on the ice and you're respecting your team and you're respecting the process, right? As long as that is never diluted or impacted because of your other interests, I think the more that that is proven, I think, you know, the guys will look to do more. And again, we live this and take a lot of pride in being creative for our players and doing things differently and thinking outside the box. I credit, you know, Pat and JP's leadership for that and how we function. At the same time, I know I probably said this a lot, but it's because it's my everyday. It's really the individual. You know, some guys are ready for something faster than another, and ready doesn't necessarily mean capable. It's just their appetite's not there yet. So it kind of happens in all different ways.
When is a kid ready for an agent? How old? Or is that just case by case? Like, at what age are you comfortable approaching a parent?
I don't know that I or anyone for that matter could. I mean, it would take a lot of brains and a lot of people to put it together. I think even young hockey players that aren't necessarily trying to play professionally can use advice. I think advice is different. I think that's the important distinction. Right. Getting advice at a young age is different, I think, than having an advisor or an agent. So I think that's an important distinction that's missed, right? The reality is hockey players, both Canadian, American, and European for that matter, or otherwise, there's a lot of options out there. I mean, I think, you know, we talked before the show, you're a parent and has a son playing hockey, and there's a lot coming at you. I mentioned, as you guys know, some of my colleagues have sons playing and playing at a high level, and they've been through it. And so there are important decisions to be made, and therefore the need for advice is there. I think a full-time agent advisor, I think it's a combination of what a family feels they need and what they can withstand without one. And I think at this point with, you know, kids deciding to go major junior, electing the NCAA path, you know, I would say, and again, not being scientific about it, around that 15-year-old age is reality. You know, personally, we'd like to see it be even a little later than that. I think the game needs to be fun. And at certain young ages, I'm not a parent, but I was, you know, played here at the time in the MTHL, Red Wings, Marlies, Vaughn Kings, and all that good stuff. And I know what it's like. I know what it's like in other places in Canada and the United States and in Europe. People are passionate. People want their sons or daughters to do great and do well. And hey, of course they should want that. I think there's got to be some tempering of when things become, goes back to what I alluded to before, distractions. And sometimes all this advice, all these opinions, not only cloud the process, but they dilute the fun. So I certainly don't have the full solution, but I like to think that we let kids play hockey, and when it's really critical for them to make decisions, that the advisor-agent role comes in. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's hard to say, like, it should be X, because there's so many different factors, and then different countries, like in Sweden, you know, Klaus and Peter, my colleagues, can speak the best to it, but they have a rule January 1st of every year is when you can start approaching players. And so I think that's kids' 16-year-old year, and you're not supposed to approach them before that. I think there's a lot of...
That's late.
Yeah.
Based on North America, that's late.
Well, and that's exactly the problem. There it fits, more or less, and I'm sure there's people that could talk pros and cons to that, but that's the conundrum. You're spot on that male players are forced to make some of these decisions really early, and it's hard for parents to go at that on their own.
My last question for you is this. Do you see any difficulty with the Maple Leafs and Matthews signing their next deal?
Right now, I'm just focused on going to the game tonight in Toronto versus Buffalo. So I think all that kind of stuff will play out when it plays out. Mm-hmm. I mean, Austin and every player that's either going to, that's can be extended, that's going to be a free agent, that is a restricted free agent. I mean, it's early. It's early. And I think now everyone who is going into the playoffs is just thinking about that. And us as advisors and representing him or other players right now, we want to keep their focus on hockey and keep it simple. players that are, unfortunately, which we feel for, that are not going to be in the playoffs, you know, those would be different conversations because it's just a different time of year for them. So that's the best I can do on that one.
Last one for me then. Not only were you pivotal in helping Austin Matthews get to Switzerland, but you also opened up an on-ramp for the Los Angeles Kings and China by introducing Luke Robitaille to the man they call Mr. Joe.
Well, yes, and that's been an amazing relationship. Very proud about our relationship with Mr. Joe and ORG. The quick rewind was Mr. Joe and his company, he's been a fan of the Boston Bruins for a long time, played goalie in the 70s. So he did a team deal with the Bruins. One of his representatives...
Why Bruins?
Well, that was the question I asked. I thought he maybe went to school in Boston or what have you, but, you know, not to age either of you. In the 70s, if you were a fan of hockey, you know, Bobby Orr, the Bruins, right? That's where he grew an affinity.
Gilbert, Cheevers, like all those old goalies.
All that. And he was playing goalie in the 70s and loved it. So that was the affinity. He does that team deal. I get a call from someone who works on his behalf here in North America, Chinese-born, saying, hi, I'm a representative of ORG, and I'd like to talk to you and JP about David Pastrnak and your Czech colleague, Alish. And I said, who is this? Mm-hmm. Right? And it sort of was just sort of an out-of-left-field call. We as a company at CAA have office space in China, and we in the hockey division have been thinking about it. And so this was a couple years ago. That relationship quickly evolved into doing, as far as I know, the first ever deal for a hockey player with a Chinese-based company. David's also having a great year, as you guys know. And so that's been a marvelous relationship for David and us. And through that, at that time, I think ORG had done a deal with the Capitals organization. And talking to them just was trying to give them ideas. And Luke and I, you know, were in the same city. And I just said, hey, I think you should get together and see where it goes. You know, it's out of – this is me putting you guys together. I have nothing to do with it. That's between you and the – and ORG. And they did a deal. And then subsequently, as you guys know, they did a deal with the league. And was a sponsor of the exhibition games, and I think it's amazing for our sport to have these people involved.
So Boston going next year to China, that's directly Mr. Joe?
I would infer there's some connectivity to that.
The sponsor would like the Boston Bruins. Oh, Boston, you're going.
Boston, Calgary, come on down.
I don't know. That's just an educated inference, I guess. But he's a great guy. He loves hockey, and it's exciting. You know, we're Canadians. I'm proud to be one. I'm proud of... you know, representing a lot of American players and spending a lot of time in the U.S. And, of course, European hockey is outstanding, but I think we're all, as hockey fans, should be really excited. There's passion and appetite in Asia and non-traditional markets. It's awesome what he's done for the game and what ORG is doing to be involved in hockey.
Listen, you've taken a lot of time out of your day for us. Judd, thanks so much for this. Really appreciate it.
That turkey sandwich is going to be really cold.
Sorry, Mom and Dad.
I hope there's a toaster. Thank you guys very much for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Tired of subscribing to multiple streaming services to get your sports fix? Introducing Sportsnet Now. Live stream the entire Stanley Cup playoffs, the Blue Jays, Raptors, and NBA, Premier League, MasterCard, Memorial Cup, and much, much more, all in one subscription. You can stream on the go or at home on your big screen from the most popular devices, including smartphones, tablets, Apple TV, Xbox, and Chromecast. Sign up for as long as you want and cancel whenever you'd like.
Good! Good. More for me and you.
Just living the dream. I love that.
Get the best bang for your buck with the sports streaming subscription that gets you the most content. Visit snnow.ca for more details. Okay, Elliot, so that was a lengthy talk with Judd. We thank him for his time. It was a nice afternoon we spent with him on Monday. You know, one of the things that I do like about this podcast
is... I wonder if his parents just left the turkey sandwich on the table.
Why are you so fascinated with the turkey sandwich? All you can think about. I can tell by the end of the interview, you're like, wow.
Because well, you know what? Like,
whatever happened to that turkey sandwich?
There was one time where I did something like that with my parents and...
and they left the restaurant?
They left. Yeah, they left.
So hang on, let me guess. You went to do a radio hit.
I don't remember what it was. Actually, no, you know what? I can't remember what happened. I did something, and it's like I can tell this story because I think the statute of limitations is up. The worst thing I ever did was, and this one wasn't my fault, It was at the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. The last night before the gold medal hockey game was a Saturday night, and there was a Tragically Hip concert, and we were invited. And it was by Labatt's. So,
it's Canada House, right?
Yeah, so yeah. We knew that there was going to be lots of drinking. And I wasn't expecting to do anything. And just before it started, I think it was Mark Gagnon won 2 gold medals in short track speed skating. So I'm like, okay, I'm not going to drink because I have to get him. I have to track him down. Yeah. And we called the liaison for media. And she told us Mark Gagnon was not going to be available tonight. You won't get him till tomorrow. I'm like, okay, green light, no problem. He shows up at the concert.
Oh, nice.
And I'm like, can we interview you?
Sober pill.
And so we interviewed him, and he was great. And no problems. The attaché was great. She was no problems. And the next day, Anthony Ciccone, my boss at the Score at the time, calls me and says, Elliot, were you drunk last night? And I'm like, dead silence. He goes, don't worry, you're not in any trouble. I go, okay, because I explain the situation. He goes, okay, I understand. And he goes, you know how I knew? And no. And he goes, well, your face was really red, and you smiled throughout the interview, and you never smile. So that's how I got caught.
What does this have to do with a turkey sandwich?
So I think I did something like that. I was with my parents, and I went to go have a beer with someone else. I saw someone else. I sat down at a beer. When I got back, they were gone. Yeah. And they said, by the way, we haven't paid the bill either.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
That's a totally convoluted lost story, but that's why I was fascinated with the turkey sandwich.
Awesome. Well, we hope that the Judd was able to find that turkey sandwich, and it wasn't indeed cold, and he finished off his lunch with his parents. But the one thing that I do like about this podcast, when you have someone like Judd on, they tell the story of how they got there.
Yep.
Because, I mean, you always get the questions I do about how do I get into broadcasting. And I would imagine he would get hounded by people, you know, that would look at him and look at his upbringing and look at, you know, how he went through hockey. Now where he finds himself now, you know, next to Pat Brisson in CAA and say, wow, how do I get there? How do I do that? Like, I talked to so many people who don't even know how to start. And, like, my answer for broadcasting is always start a blog, start a podcast. Just do it by yourself. But to become an agent – like to work at that side of things, unless you have an in to the office where you can just be like, hey, yeah, Pat, I'll make your coffee. I'll get your dry cleaning. I'll do whatever. I mean, how do you get there?
I think the one thing now is that I think there's fewer jobs now, which makes it harder. There's more consolidation of companies. But I think that for the reasons you mentioned, it's actually in some ways easier for young people to get ahead now. That's because of social media and things like YouTube.
I think they can get better faster now.
Well, but the thing is, you can create opportunities. You can be noticed. Yes. You can create your own path. Like it used to be, you couldn't be noticed. You had to knock the door down and then do something to get noticed. Now you can be noticed before you knock the door down. And if you're successful, like some of these YouTubers are, you know, there's the I've been reading about like Logan Paul a lot because he's in the news a lot for the wrong reason. There's that guy PewDiePie who's in, I think, Swedish, and he's been in the news a lot for the wrong reasons. But you realize what they've done and what they've accomplished with that vehicle. There is a way to get noticed now, unlike when we were growing up.
Yep.
That is the advantage that this generation has that we didn't have.
You wrote about Quentin Byfield, which I loved.
Yeah. Not a lot, but just a bit.
Listen, you mentioned Quentin Byfield.
You've seen him. Like, I haven't seen him.
He's a heck of a player. Yeah. I mean, he's not as physical as Lindros was, but you look at the way that he plays. He's not a tiger out there, but he's like a real aggressive hockey player who's got good size and kids can bounce off him. And I remember watching Lindros for the first time and saying to myself, how can a guy that big be that skilled? Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing that strikes you about Quentin Byfield when you first see him play. I mean, he'll be first overall.
And the one thing is, sometimes you wonder, is the kid going to go? Like, I have an affinity.
Sudbury will pick first overall.
I've heard he's going to go. Like, I have a bit of an affinity for Sudbury because I used to go to a summer camp near there.
Oh, really?
Yes. But they never win anything. They don't win for whatever reason.
Sudbury's had it tough in the OHL for a long time.
And you know what? It's like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They don't win for a lot of different reasons, I guess. But I've always been interested because I used to go up there every summer. And David Levin was a guy I had some interest in. And
Don Mills Flyers, right from Israel, played roller hockey.
Yes.
He was could he handle
very different background.
Minor midget hockey.
And so I'm glad to hear the Byfield kid's going, and I hope Sudbury finally wins something.
Quick David Levin story, by the way.
Yeah.
When he got right away, like you could tell, like this guy was a player, and his hands were ridiculous. Like he looked fantastic coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And he stayed with his grandparents. He played Don Mills Flyers. Played his grandparents' place. And, you know, they were naive to hockey. I mean, he had grown up playing in Israel. I went and taught hockey camp in Matula for a couple of weeks back in 2010 at one of, I think at that point, one of only two arenas in all of Israel's Canada Center, right up on the border near Lebanon. And anyway, he grew up playing a little bit of ice hockey and a whole lot of roller hockey, great hands and all that. So, but he comes here and he's staying with his grandparents. They don't know a ton about hockey. And he didn't, as good a skater as he was and wonderful hands, I think it was like towards the end of the season, one of the coaches, like I was fiddling around with his skates and noticed how dull they were. And so it was, when's the last time you had these sharpened? He asked his grandparents. His grandparents was like, what do you mean? You're supposed to sharpen these things? Like he had played the entire season.
Oh my goodness.
And hadn't sharpened his skates once.
Oh my goodness.
Talented kid. And that OHL Cup final when they played the Marlies, Matthew Strome ended up scoring the double OT winner. That Dunmill squad was quick. There's a kid by the name of Jacob Tortora who'll go in the draft, played from Rochester. One of the fastest minor midget hockey players I've ever seen. But David Levin was a heck of a player, and he ended up going to Sudbury as well. That was the Owen Tippett year, and who else would have been in that draft? Gabe Vilardi would have been in that one as well. Wow. They weren't going to go. Anyway, long story short. But
yeah, that's a good like that thing about the skate sharpening.
Never sharpen them.
You figured like somebody on the team would have
would
said
say
something.
Like, hey, guy, you might want to give those blades a scrape.
Yeah, seriously.
All around. That's going to be an interesting draft, too. There's some real high-end guys, just because I get to watch a lot of minor midget. There's a kid on the Marlies, Jamie Drysdale. Mm-hmm. Remember the name. He's a defenseman, just like dominate games, take over games. Cole Perfetti, who's committed to Michigan right now. Well, I'm sure Michigan would love to have him. I'm sure there's some OHL teams that would love to have him. Cameron
Tolnai. Let's wait for the sealed envelopes from both sides.
Cameron Tolnai from Oakville is another player as well to keep your eyes on. But Byfield is and has been pretty much from day one, you know, considered. And he's draft eligible 2020 in the NHL. But the interesting thing with a lot of these kids, too, is, and here's the decision you have to make as a junior hockey operator.
Yeah.
This was a nice thing if you're Erie and you're getting Connor McDavid as an exceptional player. You know, there's some of these kids that you may think about drafting, but you might not want to if they're too high-end because you're only going to have them for a couple of years. They do think like that.
I hate that.
It's true, though. Like, you think yourself,
you know what? That's a non-winning attitude.
No, when you're building junior, you know how the peaks and valleys of junior hockey teams. So this isn't like an NHL squad.
First of all, you never know how a kid at 14, 15, 16 is going to turn
out. No, but it's your job to project out.
Yes, it's your job. But secondly, you know, I would look at it this way. Like, okay, if I was Rimouski and I could get Sidney Crosby, what I'm going to say.
Oh, no, no, you take him because it fills your building.
Absolutely.
Fills your building.
Like, you don't think this kid Byfield's going to help Sudbury sell tickets and
you
stuff
know,
like that?
Here's where I thought Connor McDavid really worked in Erie, because when he would travel, like when the team would go on the road, I mean, they would pack buildings. Everywhere, to the point where more people would come see Connor McDavid on the road. They wouldn't even go watch him in Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always my, you know, we just talked to Judd about this. You know, there was that feeling that if Everett would have traded Austin Matthews' rights to Portland, the speculation was he might have gone. And I remember getting in a huge argument with John Shannon about this at the Memorial Cup in Quebec
Nobody
City.
Nobody argues with John Shannon.
Dude, it was like till 2 o'clock in the morning. Ask Damien about it. It was like, John, I kept getting angrier and angrier, and John played that. I'm from the West.
I find this scenario very believable.
It was. And Damien was actually, the Green Men were there too. They were in Vancouver. They were in Quebec City for something. So they're sitting there going, what the hell, these two bozos? Like, John and I are like screaming at each other in this Italian restaurant in Quebec City till 2 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. But just the thought that, you know, just whatever you can do to get these players in the league, because they're going to be a draw on the road. It's not just for that team, but having them in the league so wherever you go, there's more eyeballs on them and more people are coming out to watch them. I love Byfield. I think he's a hell of a player, and good on the Sudbury Wolves if that's the way that it goes down, and many of us expect it to go that way.
Wow.
There
that
you
was,
go. Quentin Byfield.
That's a good story, man.
Want to finish up with Ask 31?
Yeah. Finish up. You got a couple?
I got more than a
couple. I don't think I have any stolen fax machine stories this week.
Stolen fax machine story went over really well, by the way.
I heard.
To the point where one of our producers, Mike Razzo, even walked in and said, hey, Elliot, great fax machine story. I had to edit out a bunch of the John Tavares ones because we got a ton. We probably will continue to get a ton until a decision is finally made. This from Eric Gill. Is there any chance the Habs can land Tavares? Or is it just too perfect a fit? Not that he fixes all, but is a good start. I kind of get the feeling that he wants to go to a team that's really close to winning everything right away.
Winning is obviously going to be a huge factor. I'm sure the Islanders are going to sit down with him again and say, John, what's it going to take?
Yeah.
You know, to sign you now, just tell us, what's it going to take?
And that's not just a number, right?
No, it's not just a number. It's going to be about
how the organization
how the organization is going to work. You get into a dicey area because, you know, it's always tough. Like, do you ask your player, okay, are we happy with the organization? If you're not happy with the organization,
what changes would you like to make?
I mean, that's a tough spot for a player to be. Like, you know, Matt Sundin was one guy who absolutely did not believe he should be involved in that. And sometimes I think it was the frustration of, you know, his agents and some of his teammates who wish he would flex a bit more muscle, but he didn't believe that. It's a tough one, though. But I think the most fascinating thing is going to be who gets a seat at the table, because everyone's going to ask. I would believe this. My guess, and this is just me talking, that if the Montreal Canadiens are still interested, Mark Bergevin's longtime friendship with the agent Pat Brisson is going to get him a seat at the table. But number one, are the Montreal Canadiens at all close to winning? And number two, he's going to have to offer the max because Nevada, I could see Vegas being into this, mm-hmm. no state tax. Florida, and I still think the Lightning are going to try to find a way to be part of this, no state tax. Texas, if Dallas says, okay, we'd like to be part of this, no state tax. Montreal, I think, has the highest tax in the league right now. How are you going to beat that?
You think it should be special dispensation to offset that?
No.
If the idea of a salary cap is to level the playing field for everybody with a different taxation rate, province to province and state to state.
Yeah, you know what? This is the thing. You know, I got in trouble with Vancouver this year. If I was a player, I would play in Vancouver no problem because, A, that doesn't bother me, and, B, the rewards are so great. Like, if you are successful, you're taken care of for life.
No, but I'm talking about from a competitive balance point of view. If the whole idea of the salary cap is a level of it, philosophically, that's the way it was always positioned.
Philosophically,
and has been.
You know what? Like, the funniest thing about owners, and I'm not one of these people who tells owners what to do with their money. It's their money. They've earned it. They can do what they want. But owners never become socialists until they run sports teams.
Oh, then it's a salary cap, and it's not called socialism. It's called market certainty.
You know what? That's the way it goes sometimes. Some places you get good weather, some places you get bad weather, some places you get good taxes, some places you get bad taxes. You know what the rules are going in.
From Tom Ertz Jr., what do you think the Rangers do with their first rounders? They have three, by the way. More importantly, their own pick. What helps the franchise more, making a pick at 9 or 10 or using it in the deal for young players? Calgary looking for a first. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
What about a package for Dougie Hamilton? The Rangers lead the way with three
first-round
picks.
I do think that in Calgary...
2 seconds and two-thirds as well, so they're stacked at the beginning of the draft.
I do think that the Calgary Flames, all options are going to be on the table.
Every player?
Just about. Like, I don't think they're trading Johnny Gaudreau. You know, I'm sure they're probably not trading Tkachuk. But everyone else... It's your job to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Dougie Hamilton's, 17 goals?
Man, I would try to grab him so fast.
What happens if somebody offers you, like, a massive package? He's signed for 2 or 3 more years, right?
Uh-huh.
So what happens if someone offers you a massive package for Dougie Hamilton?
Personally, because I like Dougie Hamilton this much, I'd do whatever it takes to keep Dougie Hamilton.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you're weighing one against the other, right? You know, for example, like, if somebody called the Calgary Flames and said, after this year, we'd like to talk to you about Mark Giordano. Do you think they're saying, no, absolutely not? Or are they saying, unlikely, but what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I would say unlikely because alongside Dougie Hamilton, we may have the best combo in the NHL.
Yep.
But I'm listening. Probably more so than I am for Dougie Hamilton.
That's exactly. If somebody calls you about Sean Monahan, now centers are hard to find.
Tough.
Like, the one thing about Calgary is they've got a good cap situation. Like, all their guys are signed, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, aside from Tkachuk, they don't really have a lot of big contracts coming. But I would just look at it like this. You know what? Make me an offer. And I bet you that's what Calgary's going to do.
This from Mitch on the web. What's your favorite defunct NHL award? The award that isn't given out. There's one that comes to mind for me right away, and I don't think I've ever talked about it on a podcast before.
What a question.
There was an award, and it only existed for 1 year. There was only one winner. It was Joe Sakic. The NHL 1 year gave away an award for most points on the road,
It
was sponsored by a hotel.
I have no recollection of this.
2003? It was a hotel chain that sponsored the award, and it was for most points on the road. And Joe Sakic won it. And I was like, this is bizarre. I mean, obviously it's a promotion for the hotel, most road points. And they only did it the one season.
Wow. I don't remember that at all. I have to admit, what was the questioner's name?
Mitch on the web.
Mitch, I had to look this up because I couldn't answer your question. Do you remember this one? The Roger Crozier Saving Grace Award?
It's funny because Mitch mentions that. Mine's is the Roger Crozier Saving Grace Award.
I have no recollection of this. Awarded from 2000 to 2007, the goalie who had a minimum of 25 games and the highest save percentage, named after Roger Crozier. Winners included Ed Belfour, Marty Turco twice, Jose Theodore, Dwayne Rolison, Cristobal Huye, and Nicholas Backstrom.
Wow.
I don't remember this at all.
Emil found it, the one that I'm talking about. Let me see it, Emil. It is the NHL Sheraton Road Performer Award.
Wow.
There it is. Wait, does it have the year, Emil? 20304. Okay, so I was early on it. 20304. Joe Sakic. The one year.
That was my first year at Hockey Night. I have no recollection of
most
that
points
one
on the
either.
Road.
Jeez, I don't.
Yeah, man.
That.
Yeah.
That's kudos to you and Mitch and Emil.
Welcome to podcast world, bud. Welcome to the world of podcasting.
That one was out of my league.
From Paul Campbell. Paul writes for In Goal Magazine. Interesting guy. If I spend the next 40 years debating a single goalie interference call and eventually win the argument, is that the best possible life? If I spend 40 years arguing a goalie interference call and win.
Just don't argue it with Carrie Underwood.
Man, she went banana sandwich on that Forsberg goal, eh?
The best was, did Fisher like the tweet or retweet it or whatever it was he did with it?
That's good. From Jason J., what's going to be the, quote, hill to die on for the next CBA battle? I guess it depends which side you ask. Players would be escrow?
I was at the agent meeting yesterday, not in it, but there, and they don't think the league is going to trigger it, eh? So the league has the option first in September 1st, 2019 to end the CBA, and they don't think they're going to do it. And why would they? So 14 days later, it's the players' option, and it's going to be up to them.
Do they have a hill to die on issue?
Well, it's escrow, and it's the Olympics. You know what I heard, actually? Some of the agents, they hate the week-long period leading up to it. They hate it. Leading up to free agency.
Why?
Because they think teams are using it to gain information about what the offers are going to be.
Okay, so you just use that as a fishing trip?
Yes, and they think that, they say it's not necessarily collusion, but it's, okay, this is what this guy is looking for, this is what the market is.
It gives us a market snapshot?
Yes.
Doesn't everybody kind of already know, though?
That's what I love it, because I think it's great from a media point of view, but, that's their opinion. But I think if the league tries anything, I'm sure it'll be, shorter contracts.
Yeah, I can see
things like that.
They go after no move clauses?
I'm not sure they're going to need to anymore. Like, the expansion draft really scared a lot of teams away from them. And there's another expansion draft coming.
In Seattle, yeah.
So a couple agents told me those are going to be battles. They know it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the next CBA. I think you and I have talked. I know. One quick thought. It may give you room for optimism for the next CBA. I was under the belief that after the last lockout that Gary Bettman would not want to be part of another negotiation. I don't believe that anymore. But I'm of the belief that he wants to end his – because right now it's like legacy time for Gary, right? He's writing like legacy position stuff now. He wanted to be there for the 100-year anniversary. I have a belief based on nothing other than how I feel that the commissioner wants to go out having done a deal without a lockout. He doesn't want to be seen as just the guy that can only get a deal done with a hammer.
I don't know the answer to that question. I've debated asking him it before. I get a sense of what his answer would be. He'd probably say it's up to the Players Association. He'd deflect. Yeah. I've wondered about that, though.
I think you and I have talked about that.
At the end of the day, he works for the owners, or, he runs the owners, he represents them. But, the other thing, too, is, I learned this watching Goodenow and Bettman. They aren't players, so this is their game.
Mm-hmm.
And they are as ferociously competitive as players are. They want to win that game. Donald Fehr and Bettman, they wanted to win that game. It's competitive for them. That's their game.
But if you're writing a legacy position...
I don't know if he cares anymore.
Really, eh?
Yeah, you know, like, the booing used to really bother him. Now he handles it really well.
Good evening, Philadelphia. Isn't this supposed to be the city of brotherly love? I love your passion. Thank you so much for welcoming me and the NHL family to one of the most historic cities in America. Played a great final. Let's have a big hand for the Boston Bruins and the Chicago Blackhawks. The Blackhawks started with 24 games unbeaten this season, and this is their second Stanley Cup in 4 years. Good evening, and welcome to the 2008 National Hockey League Entry Draft. Good afternoon. It's okay, I'll bring you the gift. Oh, now the booing stops.
That makes me wonder if he's just like, that's the way it's going to be.
You know, speaking of the booing, I've always been of the belief that, because it's such a negative moment. You hate it. Here are the cups being handed out, and here come all the boos. Are you in the camp of when he comes out, he should come out with a legend to make sure that there's no booing? Here comes Gary Bettman with so-and-so Hall of Famer to hand out the Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
You believe that? There should be someone there with him?
I've seen it suggested to him before. I've asked him about it myself. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. He loves that. The one that I remember that stood out for me the most was San Jose, because I was like, how can these fans not like Gary Bettman? Like, what's the big deal? He's put a team here. Actually, sorry, that may have been before he got there. But he's fought for that team. They're a successful organization. They do things mostly the right way, and it was unbelievable.
See, the interesting thing to me is, what happens if the Winnipeg Jets win the Stanley Cup this year in Winnipeg?
Does he
get booed?
He can't. But they might just boo him because it's habit.
But that's just it. Fans have been trained now like barking seals. Yeah. Oh, you see Gary Bettman.
It's all your buddy Down Goes Brown fault, because he ranks them every year.
Thanks, Sean, in Ottawa.
Yeah, but I'll tell you this. What I do think that Bettman has is, there's 23 more jobs coming in 2020, which would be the year of the lockout. And I had one agent say to me the other day, I'd have 40 teams if we could. And I was like, God, oof. No, please don't. But I understand his point. So that's what he has. He says, you know, we have Seattle coming. That's 23 more jobs. That would be 46 more jobs in 3 years with Vegas and them. 46 at the NHL level, plus how many other ancillary jobs with that. Like, is that enough to get a deal done? I don't know the answer to that question.
40 teams, hey?
I say, he laughed, but like, I was like...
I would like that if there was a relegation element to it.
I can't see it. I
want to see games meet, like, just crushing
games. I've learned to think over the years, like, you know, like, you got to put yourself in different shoes, right? You got to wear your fan shoe, your media shoe, your player shoe, your owner shoe, right? And from a media point of view, I would love a relegation thing. But if I was an owner, I'd be like, how much did I pay for this franchise?
Yeah.
No freaking way. Yeah. Like Dave Amber's got some really crazy ideas, but you know, sometimes he comes up with interesting stuff. By the way, if you're ever looking to make a bet with Dave. Dave gambles on the worst things ever. Like, just bad. Anyway,
right.
We were talking about that league, the SPHL, picking your opponent.
Yeah.
He's like, that's what the NHL should do, and we should televise it.
I've been talking about that for years. Go back to old MVSWs. I was talking about this for years.
And we were talking about it the other day, and I was like, yeah, as a fan, hey, sign me right up. As a Rogers employee, the ratings for that show would be off the charts.
Yeah.
But who's the number one seed this year? It's Nashville. Right? Could you imagine David Poile stepping up to a microphone and saying in the first round of the playoffs, we pick.
Yes. Yes, I can.
We pick the New Jersey Devils. Not a chance is that going to happen.
Think how awesome
would
be. Like, from every single... Oh, you don't want to offend someone, so now it's a multi-billion dollar business.
Jeff.
for it's, people because we don't want to hurt. We don't want to hurt someone's feelings.
We all know it would be awesome, but you know it's never going to happen.
There would be an emotional punch in every single game of the opening round based on David Poile going up and saying something like, "We choose."
Yeah, that's why it'll never happen.
So good.
That's why it'll never happen.
Fantastic.
Of course it's fantastic. It's outstanding.
And
then, like, you know, you get who's going to interview him, like Ron, whoever it is. So, David, what is it you don't like about the New Jersey Devils you picked them to be your first-round opponent?
Yes.
Could you imagine?
Yes.
Because that way you can't talk about, respect all those guys and a lot of good guys in that room.
Well, I think their fourth line's garbage.
Yeah, I think
they
don't
like their defense.
Power play's misfiring. I don't know what this guy's thinking behind the bench with his penalty kill.
Not a chance is that ever going to happen.
Be glorious.
As a matter of fact, if it did happen, I would bet that the number one seed, whether it's David Poile, wouldn't even show up. They would say, you pick. That's what I would do. If I was the owner and we had the number one seed, I would say, you're not going. The NHL is going to pick the opponent for us.
The NHL would decide?
Yeah.
Now, if you're mandated to go from the NHL, hey, by
I'll
the
take
NHL.
The fine. What are you going to do to me?
Well, because you don't want to hurt someone's feelings.
Well, you know what? You know,
Come on.
I don't care about hurting someone's feelings. When I get off this podcast, I'm going to go hurt 10 people's feelings.
No, I'm talking about like if you're Nashville, just for example.
No, but
like you don't want to make the pick.
Why would you ever want to give somebody else even more incentive to beat you in such an emotional sport?
Pull back for a second and get out of the myopic world of just thinking about your team and who you're facing off. We keep hearing so much.
You know
hear about a lot because of good of the game.
In
the
playoffs,
the
all I care about is my team. I don't care about everybody else. You know what, Jeff?
What's that?
If you own another team in the regular season, I hope you do great. I hope you make a lot of money. I hope you're better for the league. But in the playoffs, F you. I hope you go out in four games.
Everybody watches the games. Everybody goes to those games. Everyone is keenly interested in those games because you've made
I hope in the playoffs you lose in four games. I'm not doing anything that can help you. If you're playing us, I hope you lose somehow in two games.
How about from this one, from Fat Dad, one of our favorites. What is your favorite opening round series of all time? Your favorite opening round series?
Oh, yeah, there's some great ones. I always remember Vancouver and Calgary 89, the year Calgary won the cup. Joel Otto in overtime. That was an unbelievable series. You know, Calgary was the heavy favorite. Vancouver was the heavy underdog. They took them everywhere that they could go. I always remember my first Hockey Night in Canada playoff series was Montreal-Boston in 2004. For all of Montreal's great history, that was the first series they ever came back from a 3-1 deficit. They beat Boston in seven games. But I just remember because it was my first one.
Right.
So that one always stands out. You know, Toronto-Detroit, 1993. You know, I'm not the biggest Leaf fan, but I grew up in Toronto. And that
was Nikolai Borshevsky just saying unbelievable over and over again to Ron McLean ringside.
Yes.
How you feel to score and play tonight?
Oh, I very want to play because five games I don't play. Today, for me, too heavy. Our team win. Oh, unbelievable.
Like, Toronto had been so bad for such a long time, and that team came back, and it was exciting in the city. To live in Toronto at the time, you had, you know, the Maple Leafs going to the playoffs in 1993, and months later you had the
Blue Jays.
The Blue Jays winning their second World Series. And it was months after they won their first one. It was a really unbelievable time in Toronto. Montreal-Quebec, was that a first-round series?
Don't think it was. You're thinking of the massacre, right?
Yeah.
That's the Slager-Hamel fight?
Yep.
I don't think that was an opening round, but if it was...
I remember that one.
I think we all remember that one. You know who was there? Wrestling fan. And there's shot. As the camera pans by, there's a shot of him. Uh-huh. About a month before he was murdered in his house, gangland style.
Do you know Bravo?
You know Bravo.
Really?
Was at that game.
Wow.
There's video of it on Hockey Night in Canada. There's stills that you can see on the internet of Dino Bravo
gone
at
on
that
the ice,
game.
Cleaned up that mess.
Would have been safer for him than what ended up happening.
I remember
to Dino.
Michael Farber wrote about that for Sports Illustrated back when I kept all my old magazines. And I remember Terry Johnson of the Nordiques was quoted as saying, "I've cut myself worse shaving." And I think Farber wrote, "He must shave with a jackhammer because he looked like a bloody mess." So I don't know if that qualifies a first-round series, but that one was certainly up there.
The Islanders-Maple Leafs 78.
That was second round, wasn't it?
It must have been because they faced Montreal next. I think Maple Leafs might have played L.A. first. But the thing about that one to me, when you grow up in Toronto, every player, every event gets the big treatment.
Yep.
Every tiny little thing is enormous. And there's one event in that series, I think that was second round, but there was one event in that series. That series goes game seven,
yep.
Landon McDonald scores on Chico Rush. Every Leafs fan has seen that a million times.
Yep.
But there was also something else that happened in that game seven in overtime. The Maple Leafs fans never talk about, and it was enormous. It's a play in overtime. Randy Carlisle's got the puck. Right side defenseman passes over to Brian Glennie, who fumbles it. Okay? Billy Harris and Wayne Merrick come in overtime on Palmatier 2-on-0.
Oh, yes.
And Palmatier makes the save.
Yeah.
Like, should that not live in this world of gigantic myth and story in Maple Leaf land? Like, it's one of the biggest saves a Maple Leafs goaltender has ever made.
Yep.
Has ever made. Never a peep.
That's a good point.
Never a peep. We always focus on the
land. We always blow things out of proportion.
Always, yeah. Right? But somehow, I was a big Palmatier guy growing up. He was my favorite. That's the one that always jumps out at me. How come Maple Leafs fans don't make more of that moment? Billy Harris, the shot, probably should have passed over.
He got traded to Toronto later, too. Billy Harris.
He was a hell of a junior, too.
Yes, he was, for number one overall pick. You know, Emil, we're taping this. It's 3:20 on Wednesday. Didn't Jeff say he had to leave at 3 o'clock?
I do. I'm a little bit behind time.
Where are you supposed to be? Don't tell me it's pick up your kids at school.
Not pick up kids at school, but kids got hockey practice because they have a tournament this weekend in Whitby. So I'm going to end the podcast.
Is it at Glenn Healy's house or no?
No, but Heels is free to drop by. Actually, first game is against
Don't be late for your kids' practice.
I'm not, so we're wrapping up the podcast. Emil Delich, thank you so much. Who else should we thank? We should thank Judd Moldaver for stopping by. He was fantastic. And thanks to Mitch on the web for giving us a really great question.
And thanks to everybody who listens and participates.
Yes, participate.
Because you keep us employed, three of us.
Thank you for lending us your ears. We thank you for downloading the podcast. Please continue to do so. And please continue to help support our sponsor.
You know, I remember when I was a kid, there was a newscaster in Toronto, Joe Morgan. He was CKEY, did the morning news. I loved him. He always finished his newscast by saying, "My time is up. Thank you for yours." Love that.
I know you think I think too much, but I don't know if he's enough.